So, okay, so about the Son. We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 1, and this is a book that is really, it's about the transition from, Monty, I'm just trying to get the text a little bigger on the notes there. This is a book about the transition from the old style of worship that the Jews are so used to into the new style of worship that was introduced by Jesus when he came on the scene. So it's a great book. I'm really excited that we're going to be able to study this in this CT here. I'm going to kick that series off today, and I hope you enjoy what we're going to cover. So usually when we start a new series, we like to talk about who the author is. And in this case, we don't know who the author is. There's some suspicion that it's Paul. No one identifies themselves in this book. Other people think it might be somebody that was in ministry with Paul or somebody that Paul taught, because the similarities in the book are very similar to the letters that Paul wrote. So thematically, it fits right in line with Paul. All that said, it doesn't really matter who the author is. What's important is the content that we're going to be studying, and the content is really good in Hebrews. It's really important for us as Christians to understand the difference between the way things used to be with God and the way things are now. It's great news is what we're studying here. So let's go ahead and get in and talk really about the purpose of the passage that we're studying today. So the author starts out in this Hebrews chapter 1, correcting a belief that following Jesus can be simplified into a form of ritualism, of legalism. That is, following a set of rules and rituals, or performing according to God's law in order to be accepted by him or to relate to him. He argues that because Jesus is God's Messiah, that he's better than the Old Testament Judaism that these Christians are used to. In fact, in the book of Hebrews, he uses the word better 13 different times to bring this point home, that this new way of worship is better than the old way. Jesus is better than the Old Testament prophets. He's better than the angels. He's better than Moses. He's better than the Levitical priesthood, the sacrificial system. He's replaced all of it. He's ushered in a new way to relate to God, and that's through a relationship, a personal relationship with Jesus. It's better. The author also wants to make it clear that returning to Judaism is not an option for these Jewish Christians. And that's not because Christianity is at odds with Judaism. It's not. It's actually the completion of Judaism. It's what Judaism always pointed to. So that's not it. What the problem tends to be with these folks is they haven't fully appreciated or comprehended what the significance of Jesus is, who he is, and what he's accomplished, what the implications of that person are. So that's what he's teaching on here. The audience is persecuted Jewish Christians who, according to the bullet point here, may be feeling a tendency to drift back toward that Judaism. So why feel that drift? Why should they feel that drift back toward Judaism? Well, imagine that you are a faithful Jew, and you have followed God's rituals, the traditions, the religious calendars, the festivals. You've obeyed the law as best you can your whole life. And then this Jesus character comes on the scene. You've either seen him, heard him, or maybe you've heard about him through the people that taught about Jesus. In any event, you eventually place your faith in him as the Messiah. You agree that he is the Messiah. And then somewhere along the line, you find yourself being persecuted for that faith. See, Judaism was something that was recognized in Rome as a legitimate religion. It had legal protection. It was recognized by the Romans. And initially, Christianity was as well, because it was seen as a sect of Judaism. So it also had the same view, if you will, from the Roman governing authorities. But over time, it fell out of favor in that regard. It became its own sect, its own religion, and it no longer had that protection or that recognition by the Romans. So Jewish Christians found themselves not only a target of persecution from other Jews who hadn't yet accepted Messiah, or Jesus as the Messiah, but also now the Roman culture, the Roman governing authorities were persecuting them. So you can imagine the temptation would have been pretty strong to go back to Judaism. After all, it was recognized by the Roman authorities, right? So they had the legal protection, and it was from God after all, right? This is something that God gave them. So where could I go wrong? I have the protection. I'm doing something that God has told me is okay. So on what authority, as a believer in God, as a student of the scriptures, on what authority should I believe that the way of relating to God that I've been practicing my whole life is now obsolete, is now replaced? Well, the author of Hebrews takes that challenge, and he says it's on the authority of Scripture that the old way is being replaced, that the old way is now obsolete. So once we get into Hebrews here in chapter 1, you're going to see right out of the gate we have an author who uses a series of Old Testament passages and references to the Old Testament to prove just that point, that Jesus is the Messiah, that he's the Son of God, and the message of grace that he brought is sufficient, and it's greater than what they had before. It's better than what they had before. So let's take a look, starting in verse 1 of chapter 1. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. Okay, so God spoke. God's been speaking throughout time, and now he's speaking through his Son. Through the prophets, God spoke in many ways, at many different times. But through the Son, he's speaking in the ultimate way, in a definitive way. He's making a statement. I like this analogy. I heard another teacher in our fellowship use this analogy, so I'm going to steal it. Imagine a full moon on a cloudless night. What does that look like? It's a bright light against a black sky. It illuminates the things around you. You can actually navigate under a full moon without any clouds in the sky. And what's that moon doing? It's reflecting the light of the sun, correct? So imagine the prophets are the moon, and they're in the sky, they're reflecting that light. But what happens as the sun rises in the east to the moon, even a full moon? It becomes less and less radiant. Once the sun comes up, the sun illuminates the sky. You can still see the moon in the west, but what is it? It's a small, insignificant white disk. It's no longer providing the light or reflecting the light. The source is what's illuminating the sky at this point. The sun, S-U-N, in this analogy is Jesus, the sun, S-O-N. He's the source of the light that the prophets were reflecting. And now that he's on the scene, their role is becoming less significant. They're fading. Jesus is providing the light. He's the reason. So the point is this: if God's prophets were authoritative, how much more authoritative is the Son when he comes onto the scene? So about the Son, what about him? It says in verse 3 that he provided purification for sins. So you may be familiar with the Old Testament sacrificial system. If you're not, I'll give you a kind of a rundown of what it's all about. So God gave his people a system of laws, of rules to follow, to help them to be as pure as they could, but to set them apart from the cultures around them, to be unique, to be holy. And when people, as we do, violate that perfect moral standard that God has for us, he calls that sin. And God demands justice for sin. He demands payment for sin. When we violate those rules, we've sinned, and he needs payment for that. And in God's system, payment for sin is death. So what he's given the nation of Israel here is a sacrificial system by which they can actually substitute a blameless animal from their flock and lay that down as a sacrifice for their sin. So that's a substitutionary atonement for the sins that they've committed. Gives them the opportunity to admit their sin before God, to seek his forgiveness, and to express faith in God that he's going to forgive them for that sin that they've committed. Now, this whole system has always pointed toward the eventual Messiah, the only possible complete and perfect payment for the sin of mankind, and that is his son, Jesus Christ. You see, these animals are substitutes, but they didn't really pay for the sin. They were symbolic. It was an expression of faith that the people would come and they would lay these animals down, these blameless animals down, as a sacrifice to show God that they were sorry for their sins and they needed his forgiveness. Those were just symbols. They always pointed to Jesus as the only possible blameless sacrifice that was capable of paying for an infinite amount of sin, all the sin of mankind. So what we are asked to do when we hear about Jesus is to place our faith in that person of Jesus, that he provided that perfect sacrifice, the only possible sacrifice that could pay for our sin. When we do that, when we choose to have Jesus' death on the cross applied to our lives for our sin as payment, we become a Christian. But not only that, it's not just a name, it's the start of a relationship. We are adopted into God's family at that point as one of his children, and we're excused. This is the great news. We are excused from the judgment that we deserve, the judgment that was meted out on his son, and in the Old Testament system, symbolically on those animals that were our substitutes. So this is grace. You hear us talk about grace a lot. This is God providing a way for us to have a relationship with him, which is not something we deserve based on our good works. And it also allows us to avoid what we do deserve, which is the punishment for our sin. So it's kind of two things in one. It's great news. And if we just express our faith in him and allow that to be applied to us, we can have that gift that he offers us. So it says that after he provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. That is a position of high honor. It's a position of high honor. It says that what he says can be trusted because he's God in the flesh, and he has ultimate authority. What he says matters, and what he says is that he is the replacement for the Old Testament system. It's through him now that we can come to the Father, not through a set of rituals or sacrifice anymore. This is through a personal relationship with him, just you and Jesus. And the purpose of what we're reading today and what we're going to be reading throughout Hebrews is to convince us that he is the replacement and that he does have the authority to make that claim. So let's keep moving forward, picking up in verse 4. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. So I don't know about you, when I read this, there's a long dissertation here in the middle about angels. It's kind of weird. Why is there so much discussion of angels? Well, when these authors put stuff down, they're responding to something that they're seeing. So there are some important points to be drawn out of this. So let's look at a few of them. So in rabbinic teaching at the time, they believed that the entire Old Testament was transmitted by angels. And angels were often on the scene in Old Testament revelation. We see them. They make a lot of appearances. They speak to the prophets, and God speaks through them, and they deliver messages. So there's some truth to that for sure. But this had earned the angels a place of reverence that maybe was, well, not maybe, it was unfounded. In the early Christian church, people were thinking that angels were the intermediaries between us and God, and there's just no biblical foundation for that. There was also some tendency to worship angels or to even consider Jesus an angel, a high angel or the highest of angels. What the author wants to prove as we go through these next 8 or 9 verses here is that Jesus is superior, and he is worthy. He's superior to the angels, and he is worthy of our respect and our worship. So let's go through those verses. Verse 5, picking it back up. For to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I've become your father? Or again, I will be his father and he will be my son. And again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. And speaking of the angels, he says, he makes his angels spirits and his servants flames of fire. But about the Son, he says, your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. A scepter of justice will be the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has set you above your companions by anointing you with the oil of joy. He also says, in the beginning, Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. You will roll them up like a robe, like a garment. They will be changed, but you remain the same, and your years will never end. To which of the angels did God ever say, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation? So we have a lot of Old Testament references here. If you look at your Bible, you may see there are little footnotes or maybe notes in the margin that are telling you that these are quotes from the Old Testament or references to books in the Old Testament. The significance of the passages that are being referenced here is that they are either known to be or believed to be references to the Messiah. This point wouldn't have been missed by the readers of this. Verse 5 actually has a couple that when discussing this father-son, son-father relationship that you see in verse 5. One is a quote from Psalm 2:7, and the other is a reference to 2 Samuel 17, which is a passage that discusses a promise that God made to David about his kingdom. He promises David that he'll have a son. Turns out that son is Solomon, who will build a temple for God, who will have a successful reign, and that he will have God's favor during that reign. But the rabbis of the time and the rabbis reading this letter would have also recognized that that passage in 2 Samuel was also referring to the Messiah, the coming Messiah. So he's making a point here. This is about the Son. Verse 6, it says, the angels are to worship him. And this reference is to Deuteronomy 32:43 and to Psalm 97:7. Both of these passages declare that angels are to worship God. It's interesting. Does anybody know what the first commandment is? Shout it out if you know it. That's right. You shall have no other gods before me, Exodus 23. It's an interesting point. Let's take a look a little bit deeper in this. Psalm 97:7, one of the two that is referenced here, and the second commandment, which we're going to look at in a second, both warn against worshiping created things or anything other than God. Let's take a look at both of them. Psalm 97:7 says, let all that worship graven images be ashamed who boast of their idols. Worship him, all ye angels. And Exodus 20, verses 4 and 5, which is the second commandment, says this, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. That's interesting to me. I'm a jealous God. You're not supposed to worship anything but me. Why would a jealous God who insists that we worship no other command us to worship the Son unless the Son is worthy and equal to him? I think this is great support for anybody that's not sure where Jesus is on the whole God spectrum. This is great support for he's God and he deserves our worship. Moving on, verses 8 and 9, where it says that the Son is anointed. Again, this is a quote from Psalm 45, another messianic quote. They would have been familiar with this. Verses 10 through 12 that we looked at, refer to the Son's role and presence during creation and his eternal nature. Okay, these are definitely God-like terms. This is a direct quote from Psalm 102, verses 25 to 27. And Paul unpacks this idea of Jesus and the divinity of Jesus and his role in creation really well for us in Colossians chapter 1, if you want to turn there. And I will have it on the screen as well. Colossians 1, verses 15 through 19 says, "The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him." He's talking about Jesus. He's talking about the Son. And finally, verse 13, it says that the Son will sit at God's right hand. Another quote from the Psalms, Psalm 110:1 in this case. So these Christians that are receiving this essay, they've already accepted that Jesus is the Messiah. That's not what the author is arguing here. What he's trying to illustrate is that after reading these Old Testament passages that they've just gone through, they can't look at the scriptures that they're familiar with anymore without understanding them to be about the Messiah, without understanding that the Messiah is not only Jesus, but that he's creator, he's king, he's God. But Jesus held the prophets and the law in high regard. He wasn't critical of them in saying that they were inaccurate or wrong. He had this to say about the law and the prophets in Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 18. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." So the author says, picking up in chapter 2, "We must pay the most careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. For since the message spoken through angels was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore so great a salvation? This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him." So what is it that they have heard? Well, they've heard that he's fulfilled the Old Testament law, and he was the one that the prophets had been talking about. Jesus said this himself. Salvation is by Jesus alone. That's the message that they've heard from the apostles. And it was confirmed by their teaching. It was confirmed by the apostles' eyewitness testimony. They saw Jesus' ministry. They saw him crucified. They saw him raised from the dead. They have credibility. These apostles that carried this message out and planted these churches, they went to their death as a testimony that what they were saying was true. They had been taught the truth. The readers of this letter had been taught the truth, and they needed to pay attention to what they'd heard. But still, they're drifting away. At least that's the implication from the letter. They're getting close to drifting away, maybe, because of persecution that they were feeling. So how are they doing that? Well, they're moving back toward that old system of practicing the law and wanting to go back to that sacrificial system that they were so used to. They have this idea that you can be good with God because you're doing what he wants you to do or what he's told you he wants you to do. This idea is still pretty common in the Christian church. Today, it's works-based religion. It's trying to earn or keep God's acceptance by what you do, by doing good deeds, by doing works, and avoiding sin. That's a big one. We call that legalism. It's as strong as it's ever been. So things like going to church, you know, make sure you make it to church on Sunday. Make sure you give the 10%. Serve other people. You know, we like our checklist, don't we? We like to look at stuff and say, I've accomplished these things. I'm supposed to do this, so I'm going to do it. We like our checklist because we can look at it and we say, I'm a good Christian. I did what I'm supposed to do. That makes me feel good. Well, what is that really? That's really just pride is what that is. Thinking that you can do it on your own when really we can't. We're all sinners. We all fail. Those are good things that we do. It's good to be in this meeting. It's good to fellowship with other people. It's good to serve. It's good to support the ministry of the church. But where it becomes a problem is when the motives are in question. If you're doing it out of obligation as a task, or you're doing it because you think you need to do it to be accepted by God, rather than doing it because you're motivated by the grace that he's given you. We're not going to be saved. We're not saved by doing these things. That's not what saves us. It's grace that saves us. So the answer is no. We're not good because we keep his commandments. That's not what makes us good. The whole point of Hebrews, as we study this, we're going to find out, is that it's about departing from that idea that the old covenant, the system of worship and rituals are needed. Those are obsolete now. They all just pointed toward Jesus. So they've been replaced by something better. They're just pictures of what was to come. And we can't keep the law anyway. I think most of us realize that. At least if you sit in teachings at Zenosh, you know that we are not perfect, that we all sin. Romans 3 makes that pretty clear. I love this. This is one of my favorite passages. Romans 3:20 tells us what the law is for, since we can't follow it. It says, for no one can ever be made right with God by doing what the law commands, because we can't do it. The law simply shows us how sinful we are. So think of the law, God's, let's say, Ten Commandments, just to give you a frame of reference. Think of it as an x-ray. It diagnoses the problem in our life. It shows us that we've fallen short, but it does nothing to treat the disease for us. We can't earn God's acceptance by following the law. And for these Jewish Christians that were receiving this book, going back to those rituals, those pictures of what was to come, it's already here. It's not okay. You can't do that. Earlier on in the discussion today, I mentioned that when we choose to follow Christ, when we choose to invite him into our lives, we become adopted as one of God's children. And many of you know that my wife and I adopted one of our children, Vanya. She was from Haiti, and part of the adoption process was us getting the opportunity to go visit her in Haiti, which was just a tremendous experience when we got to do that. When we were there, we got to see the conditions that she lived in, the orphanage and the just abject poverty around where she spent the first couple of years of her life. But when we were there, we got to bring pictures of our family and share those pictures with her, which was pretty neat. We got to introduce her to her brothers and sister and let her kind of look at those and get to know us a little bit and spend time with her for that week that we were there and feed her and just love her up for a week. So imagine we finalize the adoption, we get to bring her home, and she chooses to go back to Haiti and just keep the pictures and the memories of what was to come instead of coming and enjoying the love that we had to give her. I share that story because it's heartbreaking to me to think that she would do that, to say, I reject you, Mom and Dad. I just want to go back to the pictures that you gave me, that gave me an idea of what it would be like in a relationship with you, in your home, with my new brothers and sister. And that's what we're doing when we go back to an old way of relating to God. He's adopted us into his family through the blood of Christ. And when we say, I want to go back to relating to you by doing good works and following your commandments, what are you really saying? You're rejecting him. You're rejecting Jesus. You're saying, Jesus, your sacrifice, I appreciate it, but it wasn't enough, or it wasn't necessary. You're rejecting what God has offered us, a relationship with him. So even worse than that would be to deny who Jesus is, who he says he is, the truth of who he is. There are some so-called Christian faiths out there who deny the divinity of Jesus. They don't believe that he is God in the flesh. Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, for example, have a distorted view. Now they have some very interesting and important points about Christianity, which are accurate. But on this one point, they're off. Mormons teach that Jesus was a created being. He was created just like all of the demons and the angels and the spirits and human beings and Satan, and that he received as an inheritance, he received his godlike powers and his divinity when he was created and brought into this world. And only because he chose to honor and glorify his Father was he exalted, as opposed to what his brother Satan did, which was to reject his Father and rebel against his Father. I've got a big problem with that, because it's not what the scriptures say about Jesus. It's not what the scriptures say about the Son. While those faiths may profess that they're saved by Jesus, if that's what they believe, they're believing in someone who's not capable of saving them. How can a created being that isn't to be worshiped be capable of saving people without true divinity? It takes God, who is an infinite being, to pay for an infinite amount of sin. So let's take a look at a couple of passages that support who Jesus is. I love John chapter 1. It says here that in John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, and then again in 14, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." So the Word, the Word, the Word. So the Word is referring to Jesus, which is fairly clear when you get to verse 14 when it says the Word became flesh. But why not just say Jesus? John wrote this book. Why not just say Jesus, Jesus, Jesus? Well, he wanted to take it a little bit deeper when he wrote this. And what he used was, it was written in Greek, and the word he used in Greek was logos. Now, the word logos had a couple of meanings. It was used by Jews and non-Jews alike. And for the Jews, the meaning was revelation. It was the word by which God created all things and governs all things. And for the Greeks, it was a word that was used to describe the governing principle behind things or the reason for things. So he's talking about Jesus, but he's giving them more than just the name. He's giving them the what's behind the name. He's emphasizing that, yes, he was a man, he came in the flesh, but also that he was eternal, that he was God, that he's creator. And there's another passage in Philippians chapter 2 that I like. Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11. "Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. For this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God. Of God the Father." So I want to read between the lines a little bit on this one. He existed in the form of God. He existed. He wasn't created. That implies eternal nature there. He emptied himself of his divine attributes and power, is what this means. Said another way, it means he set aside the use of his divine attributes and divine powers temporarily while he was here on earth. It says taking the form of a bondservant. So he wasn't created as one. He took on that form. So he was one thing and became something else for a time. He humbled himself. He gave up his position in the Trinity to come here. He left Trinity. He left the position in the Trinity, perfection, to come here, humbled himself, to live this life that we have, to lay it down as a payment for us. It says that every knee will bow at the name of Jesus, that Jesus is Lord. So does this passage sound like a passage that describes some sort of created being with a lesser stature than God the Father? It doesn't to me. So about the Son, just to recap some of the things some of the claims that have been made. God the Father spoke through him. So though Jesus as the Son had the authority, he was a vessel through whom God worked. He made the universe. He was active and present. He was part of creation. He's the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of God. He's God in the flesh. He sustains all things. He's still active today. His work isn't done. His work of salvation is done, but he's still active today. He's the atoning sacrifice for our sins. That's what he did when he made purification. He atoned for our sins by laying his own life down. He sits at the Father's right hand and is to be worshiped. He is supreme, and he demands and commands our worship because of who he is. So what's the risk? What's the risk of a teaching about Jesus that minimizes his role in Christianity? What's the risk of a teaching that says we still need to perform to earn God's acceptance? That risk is people's souls. There's a big risk here. It's important to understand that people in this church that were reading this letter, some of them may have been investigating. Maybe they hadn't made a decision yet. Maybe they're being influenced by things that they're hearing about, you know, still doing the whole Jewish ritual system, and they're missing the point about the sufficiency of Jesus Christ and the sacrifice that he made. Some people around us may be in the same boat. Maybe they haven't made a decision, and they're investigating. It's important that we stay true to the message of Christ and who he is, so that we are not leading seekers astray or followers astray. There's a cascading effect there. If we teach things that are wrong, it's going to be retaught, and people are going to be missing this opportunity to know Jesus on a personal level. And if we allow that to happen, we have to ask, what are they putting their faith in? They're putting their faith in a false God, perhaps, or false teaching, or a false religion. And there's accountability, too. There's accountability for teachers. 2 Peter 2, 1 through 3 says, there were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their depraved conduct and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with fabricated stories. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping. So those are harsh words for teachers that are teaching something different than what the message that Jesus brought. Jesus said this, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." And that is a personal, I said it before, that's a personal relationship that he's offering, free of ritual, free of sacrifice, free of any expectation of performing according to the law in order to be accepted by God. And we need to pay attention to what it says. Not just the readers of this letter, but we need to pay attention to what it says as well. We don't gain salvation by choosing how we're going to worship God, or how we're going to relate to God. Romans 10:9 makes it pretty clear. It says, if you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead and continue to practice the law because Jesus is not fully God and therefore not fully capable of saving you, you will be saved. No, it doesn't say any of that, right? It doesn't say any of that extra stuff. It says, if you declare with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he was raised, you will be saved. There's nothing else in there. There's no law. There's no ritual. There's nothing like that in there. This is the takeaway that the readers of this letter needed to understand, and that's a takeaway for us as well. Last week, we learned about the temple and that there was a veil or a curtain in the temple that separated the most holy place where they had kept the Ark of the Covenant, where God symbolically resided among the people. But this veil or this curtain that was there because God couldn't be among the sin, couldn't be amongst us as sinners. There had to be separation there. But when Jesus was crucified, what happened to that veil? What happened to that curtain? It was torn. And that signified that no longer is there a separation between us and our Creator. Now, through Jesus the High Priest, our intermediary who laid his life down, that separation is now gone. Now we have a relationship with the Father through his Son, Jesus Christ, the High Priest. And that idea of Jesus as the High Priest is something that we are going to get into more as we study this book, but we're not going to get into that today. But just understand that Jesus is inviting you into that relationship. He wants to be that atoning sacrifice for the sins that you have committed. So if you haven't made that decision to invite him into your life, I encourage you to do that today. So I'm going to leave it right there for this week. Thanks for coming out. That is the first part of Hebrews. I think we're going to do another Hebrew study next week, and then we'll have an Easter teaching after that where we'll go back to Matthew, I think, and then back into Hebrews. If you are a first-time guest, we have books that we give away. If you're interested in one of those, How Good Is Good Enough is a good book that talks about what we're talking about today, this works-based mentality in relating to God, and it helps you understand that if you believe that, it lets you know how good you have to be in order to qualify. And discovering God as a God for those that are just interested in Christianity, investigating the claims of Christianity. Please let us know what you think of the meeting today by filling out the welcome card. And as the baskets come by, you can drop that in there. If you're a guest here, please let us know what your impressions are. We do read all these, and we'll get back to anybody that needs to hear back from us. And we will also have an opportunity during the comment section to support the financial needs of the ministry. If this is your church, there will be a hat passed around to do that. If you're a guest, we don't want you to put money in that basket. We'd rather just hear what you have to think by you filling out your feedback card. Those of us that have children, please remember to pick them up by 11:45. They'll be back in Oasis until then. So we do have plenty of time for some comments and questions, if there are any, before then. So raise your hand if you have a question or a comment, and someone will bring you a mic, and then we'll pray together afterwards. Everybody's convinced. All right, right here.
Thank you for the teaching, Adam. I remember when I first started coming around, I thought, I'm doomed. I'm going to hell. And I was at a home church. I'd been going, and I heard Kendall say past, present, and future, mm-hmm. and grace. And I was just so relieved. And thank you again for your teaching.
Yep. Yeah, that's that's not uncommon, the message of to have that reaction until you hear the message of grace. What a piece of great news that is. You know, when we hear the gospel means good news, and when we hear that we don't have to do anything to earn God's favor or acceptance, it's so freeing. And for somebody that comes from a background where you believed that good performance was what was needed for you to qualify for God's acceptance, it's good news, but also there's a struggle. For me, there was a struggle to get through that news and believe it. Like, I didn't initially believe. I'm like, there's no way it can be that easy. You know, I've heard teachers in this fellowship say that grace is scandalous and that grace couldn't be grace unless it could be abused, for example. So, yeah, that's great feedback. Thank you for for that. Over here.
The talk about angels is probably, at first, I was like thinking, well, I can't relate to that. But a lot of people do prioritize what they call spiritual experiences. And they, it's tempting to try to make that kind, you know, like, I had a certain feeling, or I had a dream, or I got this impression. And a lot of people give a lot more authority to that than the actual words of Jesus. And so for me, that's sort of an application I take of this passage, too, is that the what would Jesus say really should take priority over some spiritual feeling or thought or impression that I may have.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I know what you mean. We we oftentimes will look to spiritualize things when we don't need to, and it's always good to stick with what the Word says, what Jesus said. Yep. Anyone else? Right up front.
Thanks for the teaching, Adam. Something that you said kind of nailed it home for me when you were talking about reading between the lines on that particular slide you were looking at. And you talked about how he humbled himself out of the Trinity to come down here and do that. But I think one thing that adds to that is he didn't just humble himself that way. He humbled himself among us as well.
Yeah.
And that is the key, because what we always seem to miss when we talk about, and I say that we, I don't mean everybody, but a lot of times when you're talking to people who aren't inside the faith or whatever, is that the key to doing this, and he's demonstrated, is humility. Everything is humility. Mm-hmm. It's not what you do. It's not how you feel. It's humility. That is the key. And if you do that, everything else falls into place, but that's where we have so much trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great, great point. I appreciate you taking it that one level deeper. And what does it say? Is that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Yeah, he humbled himself, not only coming here, but humbled himself before us as well. Yeah. Yep. All right. Any other questions or comments? We have one over here.
There's two things that what you were teaching made me think about today, and one is that I know what you taught today is true, and I've heard it, and I've attended enough of the teachings and stuff to know that, but I think sometimes it's easy to get caught up in that, yeah, I know, you know, and then just get into your daily routine of life and forget about how really spectacular that is, and how it's not just about when wonderful things happen and you see good things happen to those you love and all that, but it's also like in just everyday life, you know, like I think that the devil works, and this is just my opinion, I think that he preys upon us when we're weak, when we don't have our defenses up. And as far as dream goes, I mean, I have dreamed stuff about you and Ambien, there's no way that was from God, you know.
Yeah.
Just really weird, bizarre dreams and bad dreams. But it's like when you're just sitting around the house feeling all like that, and you're like, the devil uses that. And I'll start getting random thoughts like, yeah, what's the use? This is all, yeah, you know, come to grips, you know, you're old, you're useless, and someday you'll die and go to heaven, and so what? And I have to really guard against that every day is another day to find glory for God, and that's something my sister, by sharing a Bible verse every morning with us, she always tries to glorify God in everything, almost to the point that if there were people that weren't believers read those, they would find ridiculous, because she'll be like, right now they don't have heat, their furnace is broken, and she's got all these physical problems, and she'll say, praise be to God, you know, glory in God, no matter what this is that he has planned for us. But if other people were reading, they'd be like, oh boy, you guys are lunatics, you know?
to that. I mean, how can you, like, have a day that you had and say, praise be to God? But I've been trying to, I don't know if you would say train myself. I've been trying to get in the habit of, even when days are really dull, and as I told Judy this morning, you know, you get up and you feel like, oh, my God, that brick wall is still right here, you know? I thought you would move it in the night. Still, this is another day, and this is another day to glorify God, and I just have to remember that He's in charge, and I also have to remember that even though I'm glorifying God and all that, that my children who are not allowing me to orchestrate the play and run their lives, which would be so much easier if they would just do what I ask them to do, and you know, that they have that same access to Him, and it is, you just wait. You think that you're 17 and 18 year olds? Wait. Wait until they're 30 and you're like telling Bambi, oh, our Social Security isn't going to pay their rent this month, honey. And you're saying, okay, God, work in their lives. You know, it's not easy, but He's there for all of us. You know, and I think one of the hardest things I've had to do in the last couple months is to realize that I can do what I can do, but I'm human, and God has to be the God of everybody's lives. I'm not like His extension that can be the all-saving grace in everybody's life. It's just, I can't do it. So, anyway, thanks. I did learn a lot from you. I always do.
Paul said in Philippians that he learned to be content in all circumstances. I don't know how he did it, because I'm not there yet. But that is something that he told us to do. And later on in that same chapter, he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And, you know, when you talked about how Satan is at work, he works in a lot of ways. He works in the within the circumstances that he is afforded, whether it's accusing you or attacking you. And 1 Peter 5:8 says that we are to be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a lion looking for someone to devour. And he wants you out of the game. You know, a lion doesn't just get you on the sidelines. A lion devours you. It devours its prey. It wants it out. And that's what the devil is doing, is he wants to take you out. And he'll use whatever strategy he needs to do that. So, anyway. Do we have any other questions or comments? All right. We're going to pray. So if you would like to pray out loud, we can bring you a mic. And then I'll close us up. Just raise your hand if you want to pray. Well, God, I appreciate the opportunity to come up here and pray and to teach and to pray.